Coming up, should the rules about what makes meat kosher extend to how the workers in meatpacking plants are treated? And a Unitarian minister who is terminally ill says the love we give others lives on long after we are gone.
The greatest of all truths is that love never dies.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As Congress and administration officials wrestled over what to do about the financial crisis, religious leaders also weighed in. The U.S. Catholic bishops wrote to government leaders urging them to consider the moral dimensions of the crisis. They said priority must be given to the poor and most vulnerable. The Christian anti-hunger group Bread for the World cautioned that solutions focused on the U.S. economy must not derail progress in fighting poverty overseas. And Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone said the situation shows what happens when societies neglect the common good. There was renewed debate this week over politicking from the pulpit. More than 30 pastors around the country defied the Internal Revenue Service rule, which bans clergy from engaging in partisan politics from their pulpits. One of the pastors was Ron Johnson, Jr. in Crown Point, Indiana, who believes clergy have a right and a duty to speak out.
I have absolutely no problem telling you as a Christian who you should not be voting for. Senator Barack Obama's positions on the critical issues of life and marriage are in direct opposition to God's truth as he has revealed it in the scriptures.
Barry Lynn of Americans United for Separation of Church and State filed complaints with the IRS. He said churches are supposed to tend to Americans' spiritual needs, not get involved in partisan politics. White evangelicals have been a key part of the Republicans' winning coalition for the past 20 years. But Religion and Ethics News Weekly has released a new survey showing that younger evangelicals are less supportive of John McCain than their parents are. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, is here. Kim.
Evangelicals are the single largest voting bloc of religious voters. They make up more than a quarter of the American electorate. So they're very important to Republicans, and the Republicans in the last few elections have needed every evangelical vote that they could get. Our survey found solid support for John McCain among white evangelicals. About 71% say they're going to vote for John McCain, compared to only about 23% who say they're going to vote for Barack Obama. But when you look at younger evangelicals, those under 30, that margin closes. So about 62% of young evangelicals say they're going to vote for John McCain, and 30% say they're going to vote for Barack Obama. So they're still Republican, but not as Republican. And in a close election, that could make a difference.
What do the younger evangelicals think of Sarah Palin?
Well, our survey was conducted the first several weeks of September, and there was a lot of energy in the evangelical world around Sarah Palin. They liked her very much. Our survey found overall older white evangelicals very favorable toward her. Younger evangelicals, less favorable toward her, and we found a really surprising gender difference as well. Younger female evangelicals were dramatically less favorable toward Sarah Palin than older evangelical women. Less than half of evangelical white evangelical women under 30 felt warmly toward Sarah Palin, and well over 60% of the older women like her. Hmm.
And what about on the social issues, particularly abortion? Any differences there?
Well, certainly evangelicals, many evangelicals have traditionally based their vote on two key issues, abortion and opposition to gay marriage. But we found that younger white evangelicals aren't quite so tied to those issues. They're solidly pro-life on abortion, about the same as their parents. But when it comes to gay issues, we found that younger evangelicals were more tolerant. More than half of the younger white evangelicals we talked with support some form of a legal recognition of civil unions for same-sex couples or even gay marriage. That's a big difference with older evangelicals.
Mm-hmm. And what do we take away from this? What are the implications?
Well, this has been a key part of the political landscape that evangelicals were solidly Republican. If in the future that changes, that could have really big political implications. Now, what we don't know is whether these numbers are tied to this particular election, to John McCain, Barack Obama. And we also don't know whether these younger evangelicals may become more conservative as they get older, maybe get married, have kids, maybe their views will change. But certainly, if the future of the evangelical movement is more moderate, less conservative, that could have a big impact.
Mm-hmm. Kim Lawton, many thanks.
Thank you.
Major holidays for Jews and Muslims coincided this week. Security was on high alert in Israel as Jews began observing their high holy days and Muslims celebrated the end of Ramadan. For Jews, Rosh Hashanah, the new year, began a 10-day period of reflection that culminates on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, next Thursday. Meanwhile, Muslims around the world celebrated Eid al-Fitr, the joyous festival completing the Islamic month of daylight fasting. But in several places, the festivities were marred by sectarian violence. In Baghdad, dozens were killed when suicide bombers targeted Shiite mosques where people had come for Eid prayers. Tragedy also struck during a major Hindu holiday in India. More than 200 pilgrims were killed during a stampede at a Hindu temple in northern India. Thousands had gathered there to celebrate the beginning of Navaratri, a 9-day festival dedicated to the Hindu mother goddess Durga. We have a story today about a question facing many Orthodox and conservative Jews who eat only kosher food. Meat is kosher if it's been prepared according to Jewish law and certified so by a rabbi. But what if the plant managers were accused of unfair labor practices? Should kosher certification depend not only on how an animal is slaughtered, but on how workers are treated? Lucky Severson reports from Iowa, where a kosher meatpacking plant is owned and run by Orthodox Jews from Brooklyn.
This was the scene in the early hours of May 12, when authorities staged a commando-style raid on the agriprocessor's kosher meatpacking plant at Postville, Iowa. They arrested hundreds of suspected illegal immigrants, but then they uncovered evidence suggesting serious safety violations and child labor abuse by plant officials. People in this small town are still in shock, and the reverberations have rattled and divided the American Jewish community. It's a debate not so much about the raid itself, but what it uncovered. Rabbi Morris Allen.
The Jewish community is going to have to ask, is it enough for us to be satisfied that we have kosher food on our plate? Or are we also concerned that in the fulfillment of the laws of kashrut, which is a fulfillment of a way in which we bring holiness into our lives, that there has not been a desecration of people's dignity in allowing me to fulfill my holy act?
It was an odd match in the beginning in 1988 when Orthodox Jews from Brooklyn, New York, showed up in rural Postville and bought the defunct meatpacking plant on the edge of town. But over the years, Christians and Jews lived side by side, and both sides seemed to prosper. Agriprocessors grew into the largest producer of kosher food in the U.S. Including the slaughterhouse, the plant employed over 1,000 workers, with rabbis supervising the actual killing to make sure it's done in keeping with Jewish law.
It has to be done by a shochet, by a kosher slaughterer, who is a God-fearing Jew.
In fact, kosher rules are so strict, rabbis like Yoshi Edelstein work in kosher restaurants and markets to make certain all foods coming in meet biblical standards.
A kosher animal is delineated in the Bible, chapter 11 of Leviticus. God says in the Bible what animals may be eaten. For example, only certain types of animal, and those animals are kosher only because they have split hooves and chew their cud. Why these are the signs for kosher, we have no idea. God said it, we believe it, simple as that.
It's believed that almost 90% of Orthodox Jews eat only kosher food, and around 25% of conservative Jews adhere to the tradition. Consumers look for the kosher label much as they do the Good Housekeeping seal of approval. So they were taken aback when the animal rights group PETA took this video and accused agriprocessors of not slaughtering in a humane way.
I do a lot of my kosher meat shopping at ShopRite, and I have spoken to the manager of the butcher section and said I was really very upset and very disturbed by what I had heard about the plant, the agriprocessor's plant in Iowa. And he, too, was very upset and very disturbed.
But the consternation over the kosher slaughter and processing of animals has grown into concern over the ethical treatment of humans, of workers. And there's some rabbis who now want to expand the meaning of kosher.
We believe that most consumers, when given a choice between a product that says it's ritually kosher and a product that says it's ritually kosher and it's been produced in an ethical fashion, will choose the latter.
Nearly 400 immigrants were charged with immigration violations. The men are still in prison or have been deported. The women, mostly mothers, wear electronic monitoring bracelets. And it's left to religious leaders, like Father Lloyd Paul Adderkirk of St. Bridget's Catholic Church, to feed and care for the moms and kids.
The more I talk about it, the madder I get. Because we're going into our fifth month of this. They have these women with no money, no income, plus they need food and shelter and so on. So their immigration is asking us to pay for their being incarcerated right on the streets of this town.
Father Paul introduced us to Rosa Zamora, mother of two daughters whose father was taken to a Missouri prison. For 5 months, she's been wearing an electronic monitoring bracelet, leaving her unable to work or to leave town.
She said, there isn't much I can do because I depend so much on the charity of the church here. So even if her husband were deported, she wouldn't have enough money to go with him.
The agriprocessors' raid was the biggest of its kind in U.S. history, and the company spokesman, Menachem Lubinsky, questions the government's motives.
I'm not going to be the one to accuse anyone of being that selective to pick on that company because of the way they look. Maybe they look like Hasidim. Maybe they're Jewish. I'm not going to deny that their very entry into Postville, Iowa wasn't under the most friendly terms, so I believe that there was something here that just didn't add up.
But Rabbi Allen, who leads a conservative congregation in Minneapolis, says he doesn't think Agriprocessors was targeted because it's operated by Orthodox Jews, but because they treated their workers poorly. He points to the over 9,000 criminal misdemeanor charges authorities have filed against the company for, among other things, hiring underage workers and putting them in hazardous jobs. Rabbi Allen visited the plant before and after the raid.
People shared with us unbelievable stories of pain and suffering that they endured because they had no choices. If they raised their voice, they could have been deported back. And they really didn't have any place to turn to.
The government's going to have to prove that the management knew every day that these people were of underage. Remember, the imperative for these people was they wanted to make money. They wanted to help their families. And as is in every immigrant group, they'll do anything under the sun to get those jobs and to bring money into the house.
Rabbi Allen says Leviticus details kosher laws, but there are equally important laws about the treatment of workers in Deuteronomy chapter 24.
You shall not abuse a needy and destitute labor, whether a fellow countryman or a stranger in one of the communities of your land. And one text telling us what kind of meat to eat isn't written in boldface, and another text telling us about how to treat the worker isn't written in small print.
Rabbi Allen is pushing a plan to add an additional symbol to the kosher certification,
a justice certificate that says the kosher product meets biblical ethical standards as well. He says he's received enthusiastic support for his justice certificate from rabbis across the religious spectrum, but certainly not all.
I think it's more that the Orthodox feel, look, we're the basic customers. We buy this product 365 days a year. We're interested in kashrut the way it was for 3,000 years. We're not interested in redefining it.
I mean, in America, there are plenty of labor laws to deal with that. And if the government's not doing enough to enforce it, then you just have to step up what the laws are already.
It's a religious concern, and we should never leave to the government those issues that are the responsibility of a particular religious community to address.
Even though some Jewish leaders are opposed to the notion of a justice certificate, the idea may be gaining steam among Jewish consumers.
I've discussed it with my rabbi, and he's not happy about putting this into a solid, written down kind of thing. Certain things should be done without having to put them down. And yet behind this movement, I think that there was something worthwhile.
This is a major undertaking. This is the first time that a religious community has has set out to say that it is possible to demonstrate that good corporate citizenship is something that can be rewarded from a religious point of view.
The agriprocessors plant has hired a new person to run its operation with promises to make things better. The plant itself is not operating nearly at capacity because not enough people can be found to do the unpleasant work. And the illegal immigrants are still waiting to learn their fate. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Postville, Iowa.
In other news, the Dalai Lama made his first public appearance since being released from the hospital last month. The spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism taught at a retreat in Dharamsala, India, where he lives. He was hospitalized in early September for abdominal pains. Aides say the 73-year-old leader had been exhausted from his busy schedule. The Vatican is going a little more green. Workers began installing solar panels on the roof of the Papal Audience Hall in Vatican City. Rome gets a lot of sun, enough, according to engineers, to illuminate, heat, or cool the hall. Finally, we have a profile today of perhaps this country's best-known Unitarian Universalist minister, Reverend Forrest Church of New York. He has a new book out called Love and Death. Last week, Church's congregation gave him a 60th birthday party, but it was a celebration with great sadness just underneath the joy.
Wonderful, isn't that wonderful?
It was a love fest at the Unitarian Church of All Souls on the Upper East Side of New York.
Happy birthday!
The members honored Reverend Forrest Church, their pastor for 30 years, on the occasion of his 60th birthday. His wife was there, and their children, and his 85-year-old mother. The covers of his 24 books were on display. But there was a great poignancy to the festivities because everyone present knew that Reverend Church is terminally ill. He has incurable cancer of his lungs and liver, and he guesses he has less than a year to live.
I'm being gifted a month at a time, and am rejoicing in that. But eventually the treatment will lose its valence, and the barbarians will storm the gate.
Church says he was astounded at his reaction to being told he's dying.
I went straight to acceptance. I skipped shock and disbelief and anger and resentment. I went directly to acceptance.
The key, Church says, was being able to settle unfinished emotional business.
The only way to reconcile yourself, make peace with yourself, make peace with your neighbor, make peace with God, find salvation, is to break through and love, to forgive and to love. You don't change the person you forgive, you change your own heart. So anything that you can do to reconcile also means that at the end of your life, when you're given a few months to live, you can look back without regret. The two saddest words in the English language are if only. and they ring with the most poignancy at a time that a person gets a word that he or she has a terminal illness. If only I had stopped drinking. If only I had dared to change careers when I could. If only I had reconciled with my father when I had a chance.
Church did have time to say goodbye to his father, the late U.S. Senator Frank Church, during his father's last months. But he concedes he was slow to realize his duty to his family now.
When I was talking about not having unfinished business, my wife quickly pointed out to me, well, you may not have unfinished business, Forrest, but your children have unfinished business, and I have unfinished business, and let's get down to it. I realized this wasn't about my death, this was our death. And that focused me in on them. This was a time to listen, embrace, and say, I'm so sorry. And crying together and then singing the old songs.
A lot of crying?
There was a lot of crying.
During and in spite of his illness and treatment over the past 2 years, Church wrote two books. He confessed to his congregation one of the reasons for his productivity.
Steroids. Every week, the good folks at Memorial pumped me full of steroids. They helped me tolerate the poison they were pumping into me to kill the cancer. For 2 or 3 days after every treatment, I was flying. I haven't been so high since the late 60s.
Like other Unitarian Universalists, Church rejects many aspects of Christian doctrine. He neither blames God for his illness nor asks God for healing.
I don't pray for miracles. I don't pray to cure my incurable cancer. I receive and consecrate each day that I'm given as a gift. I have no idea what happens after we die. And so I go with Henry David Thoreau, who was, when he was asked about the afterlife, said, Madam, I prefer to take it one life at a time.
At the same time, Church says he's come to believe that without God, there is nothing.
God is what sustains me. I am connected with that grace and power. God is that which is greater than all and present in each. For me, Christianity is the faith about love, love to God and love to neighbor. That is right in the heart of my very being. I am a Christian universalist. I believe that the same light shines through every religious window. And it's the windows are different. It's interpreted in different ways. It refracts in different ways.
Church calls what he wrote in his new book a coda to his theology.
My lifelong belief that love and death interwoven were the heartstrings of religion. The greatest of all truths is that love never dies. That every act of love that we perform in this life is carried on into another life and passed on into another life so that centuries from now, the love carries, and that's the work of religion. The opposite of love is not death. It is fear. Fear is what armors our hearts. If our hearts are armored, they'll never be broken. And I have seen so many people get hurt in love and then try to protect themselves against it. And when they protect themselves against love, they protect themselves against the only thing that is worth living for. The secret of it all is that it's not about me. To the extent that we're self-conscious, self-absorbed, we cannot be conscious of the world around us, of God, of our neighbors. I have preached on living in the present for my entire career. Only in the here and now can we love God and love our neighbor, can we redeem the day. One of the beautiful things about a terminal illness, your friendships become stronger. Your loved ones become more vital and more present. Each day becomes more beautiful. You unwrap the present and receive it as the gift it is. You walk through the valley of the shadow, and it's riddled with light.
At the close of all the other tributes to Church, his wife, Carolyn, made hers.
I wanted to let you know how at peace Forrest is. He's at peace because he's become the man that he wanted to be. He couldn't have done that without you. You have loved him. You have supported him. You have forgiven him. And that's really made all the difference. So, darling, 60 years. Happy birthday.
And if love could heal him, there would be many more. Even with his uncertain future, church is scheduled to preach again later this month. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. There's much more on our website, including my full interview with Forrest Church. You can find more details about our new survey on the political views of young evangelicals and additional political coverage on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Living Stones Church in Crown Point, Indiana.